Welcome to the AJP Heart and Circ podcast. I'm Kara Hansel-Keehan. Today, we'll discuss a new study by Pepin et al. Titled, Racial and Socioeconomic Disparity Associates with Differences in Cardiac DNA Methylation Among Men with End-Stage Heart Failure. This article was published March 26, 2021. Joining us today are host Nisha Charkoudian, senior author Adam Wendy, and expert Bradford Hill. Let's get started.
Thanks, Kara. Heart failure is a major contributor to morbidity and mortality in the United States and around the world. A major challenge in the development of treatment strategies for heart failure patients is the extensive inter-individual variability in the extent to which patients respond to a given treatment or treatments. In the present study, Pepin et al. Used epigenetic analysis to evaluate whether inter-individual differences in treatment responsiveness or prognosis could be explained based on specifics of DNA methylation in the myocardial genome. DNA methylation was assessed as cytosine p-guanine methylation in the myocardial genome. The authors found a strong association between DNA methylation patterns and self-identification as either Caucasian American or African American. Long-term outcomes were also significantly worse in the group that identified as African American. So Adam, to get us started, could you explain the significance of epigenetic modification of the genome for people who are not familiar with it? And could you give us a brief summary of your study and the results?
So the way I'd like to describe epigenetics is really the synthesis of everything you come into contact, all the choices you make about healthy living or unhealthy living, and also some of the impact that your parents and maybe even grandparents had on how your genes are able to be turned on and off. So really, it's simply defined as epi or above the genome. And this includes a number of different mechanisms, including non-coding RNAs and histone modifications. For simplicity's sake, we chose to focus on DNA methylation, which was also one of the first epigenetic mechanisms. And really, the central dogma there is that promoter methylation, or the starting point of genes, is inversely related to gene expression. So that's what we've looked at in a number of studies now. Now, where this new study really has gotten a lot of excitement from us and really the media as well, as we'll see in a moment, is that when we started looking at these methylation marks in human patients that were undergoing a heart procedure called LVAD placement, or left ventricular assist device placement, we found that one of the strongest signals in this epigenetic mark DNA methylation was actually differentially regulated by self-reported race. And when we looked into that a little bit deeper, we found that those changes were associated with different gene expression patterns that may even help explain why African Americans have a higher susceptibility to heart failure. So that's really the main take-home message. And we're going to really see if we can prove if there's a cause and effect or if this is just an association next.
So just to follow up on that first question, we know that chronic stressors certainly affect physiology, and the chronic stressor of systemic racism might be showing up in ways that we haven't seen it before, as your findings may suggest, mechanisms for both cardiovascular disease itself and outcomes from treatment.
Now, that's an excellent point. And really, my introduction to epigenetics had to do with a different type of stress. It was really some of the early work decades ago looking at people who survived famines and some of the epigenetic programming that then occurred in their brains that led to different psychological disorders. And this has now been found to be true for all different stressors, be it pollution, or as you highlight, the stress associated with some of the systemic racism that's going on. What this study suggests is that we may now be able to measure the impact of some of those stresses on the genome, and more importantly, show that it actually has a functional outcome in gene expression, which affects heart failure susceptibility. Now, the problem is proving that, right? With this study, this was all post-analysis. We're definitely missing some important controls because in this particular study, all the subjects identified already had heart failure. What we don't know is if some of these differences in DNA methylation exist within the different populations we looked at or are actually part of the heart failure. So really to that question of do we or would we see the same differential methylation in a non-heart failure African-American, or is it the heart failure in particular? So important next steps to continue.
Right. I see what you're saying. So for example, there, it could be the combination of influences associated with race and influences associated with heart failure, or it could be one or the other. And as you're saying, a lot of important things to follow up on. Brad, I'd like to actually ask you kind of a similar question, or ask you to comment on this same aspect of stressors related to, or environmental influences, let's say, related to systemic racism, and how you think those have implications for the results of Adams Group's study.
Yes, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here today. No, it's a very thought-provoking question. I think there are many ways to respond to it. Neither myself nor Adam is really a social scientist. We're more on the biology and molecular biology side. But the overall idea, I think, whether it be racism or another environmental factor, is that the environment literally alters our biology by affecting the way our genes are expressed. And so looking at it from a bigger perspective, looking at air pollution, for example, there's numerous studies now showing that exposure to air pollution can change the epigenetic landscape. It can either decrease the amount of methylation on, for certain genes, or it can promote, for example, mitochondrial DNA methylation. And it remains to be seen whether these changes in methylation may actually impact the biology long term. But the same type of thing happens with diet. For example, there are studies in pigs and mice that show differential changes in DNA methylation that even after reversion to a healthier diet, some of these marks are retained, and thus could affect biology going further. Similarly, in post-traumatic stress disorder, there's traumatic stress, the hypothalamic, pituitary, and adrenal axis that can propagate to future generations. And it's thought that this may be due to DNA methylation that may underlie some of the generational effects. And even I think there's a lot of evidence in the area of addiction science. Investigators have gotten rodents to become addicted to cocaine. And when they do this, for example, they'll flash some sort of a stimulus like a light, and then they go through a withdrawal period. So whenever these mice or rodents see the light, even if they're not getting cocaine, they will really react strongly to it. And there were some really interesting studies where they took the mice that were addicted to cocaine, gave them a DNA methyltransferase inhibitor, and it completely abolished their addiction. So with studies such as these, it begins to start making us ask even deeper questions. Is there a sort of epigenetic memory? And is this kind of an environmental memory that's threaded through the fabric of our overall memory? These are very big questions. And when you extend them to race, you can see how this can become a very interesting topic to think about. For example, it's known that low socioeconomic status from infancy to young adulthood has marked effects in the epigenetic landscape and tends to affect genes related to immune function and skeletal and nervous system development. So I think it's a little too early to extend it fully to structural racism, but I think the seeds are there for us to start having these types of discussions about what these types of changes could do to our DNA and how long that they last and whether they're reversible or not.
Thanks very much, Brad. Those are really important points. And I think as someone myself who's not a molecular biologist, and I don't really have expertise in epigenetics, but I've heard it explained to me as within life changes in the genome that are sometimes, as you say, perpetuated into subsequent generations. And I thought it was interesting that you brought up such major stressors as things that can have really major effects on health, morbidity, and mortality, such as pollution, and then even more seriously, PTSD and addiction. It's interesting to see how with studies such as yours, Adam, it's almost like all the sciences are coming together. And I love that in a way, because it's what I loved in the first place. I'm sure you guys too, about integrative physiology. I mean, this is the reason we become physiologists, is because it's so neat how things interact, systems and levels of systems, as we're talking about now. Adam, did you want to make any additional comments on the paper from a big picture perspective, specifically as related to healthcare disparities and other structural racism issues?
Actually, yes, I would. And I think Brad really raises a good point. And we're not social scientists. I mean, I describe myself as a molecular physiologist. What brought me into this field was my love of metabolism and really a focus on how diabetes affects the heart. But Brad raised a good point about this epigenetic memory. And what was really the driver of my entry into epigenetics research was this idea that blood sugar levels could program diabetics for susceptibility to heart failure. And the anecdotal story that I like to tell my students is to really let the science drive you and to have the courage to do that. And what I mean by that is when we first got our DNA methylation data back from the first set of 11 human hearts, which was my first publication in this area back in 2019, we were looking at ischemic heart failure. But when we did the principal components analysis, we saw this really odd pattern where there were three of the patients that were separate from the other nine. And I didn't know why, because when I'd asked the surgeons for the human heart, I'd ask them for half of the patients to have ischemic heart failure and half to have non-ischemic heart failure. Well, it turned out that I didn't even think to ask about race of the patients. And those three that separated out happened to be the three African-Americans in that initial cohort. And where things got very fortunate for me is about that same time, and this is about 7 years ago now, we got a new dean, Selwyn Vickers, who brought with him this grant, the Center for Healthy African-American Men Through Partnerships. And I applied for some pilot funding from it, which really was the seed that grew into this study. But I was terrified because I wasn't a social scientist. I knew nothing about racial differences in healthcare outcomes. And I was a molecular biologist. Who was I to do this? But through working with CHAMPS, through working with other wonderful faculty here in minority health studies, really brought me into the fold and realized, well, hey, this is an important area of study. Does this study answer all the questions? No, I think like all good studies, it raises more questions than it answers. But I think it is an important next step in understanding why are certain patients more susceptible to heart failure? And could this be a mark that might explain some of what we know to be true from unequal treatment of segments of our population and why those people do end up having worse heart failure outcomes?
Thanks, Adam. So many relevant points that you just raised there. I think the one that strikes me the most is that instead of just stopping where you were and saying, oh, I'm not a social scientist, I can't do this, essentially, you didn't. And you said, okay, I need to kind of go outside my comfort zone, learn things from other colleagues who have other expertise that I don't have. I appreciate your explanation of that. I think it's really relevant for our audience and for our community to hear what the thought process that you went through.
And it's also really having the right team. I mean, I would be remiss in thanking Mark Pepin, the first author on this. He was also courageous in joining a molecular biologist lab and learning bioinformatics. And he's really been the driver of most of these studies in transcriptomics and methylomics that have been coming out of my group. And he's trained the next generation, Cheyenne and Luke, the students on the paper. So it's really finding the right people and encouraging them to be brave in any way, be it taking on a social question, be it taking on bioinformatics, or finding people that have the answers that you don't. So Bertha Hidalgo, who's also co-author on here, was really the person that brought in our understanding of geocoding and really trying to identify some of these social determinants of healthcare to overlay onto this molecular biology. So really kind of just the perfect storm, and I feel very fortunate to be at the helm of it. Really, I did little of the work, and I have to give credit to all those that I just named and the other authors on the paper.
It does sound like you have a phenomenal team, and I give them a ton of credit as well, because it's really a great paper. Let's see, Brad, I'll turn it back to you for a minute. What can we do as scientists or in our community in terms of either studies or other ways of thinking about next steps to address some of these inequities?
Yeah, so I think that's another large question. And I think it starts very simply by acknowledging the problem. Racism is a current and pervasive problem, and it produces adverse effects on the individual. And I think we have to first make sure to try to educate ourselves and others properly in the area. And then I think it would take an integrated effort, not just patients and healthcare workers, but scientists and the general public to come together and somehow and find a way to address the structural elements that impact socioeconomics, our behavior, disease risk, and disease outcomes. I think this will involve examining the impact of discrimination and structural racism on our healthcare system, and then trying to address how racism affects the health of our population and healthcare disparities. And maybe it involves trying to understand how these epigenetic changes contribute to that. I think it'll require a true call to action and a lot of integration across disciplines.
Yes, thank you. None of the things we're talking about are either simple or, you know, easy to address. And I think you're right. Step one is really to recognize that they exist. Adam, thinking about differences between different groups makes me wonder what this would have looked like if there had been some women included. And I don't know if that's something that you've looked at or thought about looking at.
So definitely thinking about doing it. I had submitted for funding to do that as well. These are not cheap studies, and unfortunately that grant did not get funded. But I just found out that my collaborator in Graz, Austria, Heiko Buger, had sent us a bunch of additional heart samples to do a similar study. We didn't realize, similar to the racial breakdown of the prior study, the sex breakdown of the current study, and he did happen to include some women in that. So we are now starting to look at that difference as well, because we definitely know that there are sex differences in heart failure outcomes, and we definitely know that there's going to be epigenetic and transcriptional differences as well. So that is an exciting next area that we're started the analysis on. And another future direction that we're actively doing is trying to maximize public databases. So there's a lot of information already out there. There's a lot of epigenome-wide association studies, or EWAS studies, that have been collected on circulating nucleated blood cells. So actually getting some of these measures from blood, because as one can imagine, it's pretty difficult to get human heart tissue. People don't usually volunteer to give that up freely.
Right.
So one of the things we've started to do is, when we get these LVAD biopsies, we've been collecting blood at the same time, and we're performing this exact same analysis of combined transcriptomic and methylomic to see how many of these epigenetic differences are systemic within an individual. So could be biomarkers within the blood. If any of these marks that we've identified are able to be identified in the blood, we could then immediately access tens of thousands of patients. So it wouldn't take decades to get to. If we could find a few marks that we could then go and then do post hoc analysis, we might be able to actually find a way to quantitatively measure some of these disparities that we were just discussing a moment ago.
Brad, were there any additional points that you'd like to add before we wrap up?
The major thing that I pulled from Adam's paper, and then just the field in general, is the idea that the environment changes how our body responds to stress, and this even extends to subsequent generations. The other really interesting question has to do with this idea of memory. You know, does this mean that our perception of environmental stimuli actually weaves a thread through our fabric of memory? And then it begs the question, are memories at some form, you know, a form of memory, of what I'm talking about, erasable to some extent? And is that something that can be done for some disease states? I think those are very big questions that's going to take years of preclinical research before we get anywhere in the translational arena, but there's a lot of really interesting work to be done.
Definitely a good way to end on the search for the Holy Grail. If we can identify which of these marks could be edited or removed, definitely could lead to treatment in not only cardiovascular disease, but diabetes, a lot of mental disorders. As you highlighted, addiction has a strong epigenetic component. Cancer does. A lot of the advances in modifying epigenetic changes has come from the cancer field, and we're hoping to repurpose some of those meds as well for cardiovascular disease. But hopefully just the sun on the horizon.
Absolutely. Well, on that happy note, I would like to thank Adam and Brad for joining us for this podcast today. And Kara, back to you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the AJP Heart and Circ podcast. Our theme music was written and performed by Ray Mitchell. Catch the latest episodes of our podcast at physiology.org/journal/AJP Heart.